Well, he was a naturalist. At the age of 51, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of Species. Would have been 200 years old this year. Of course, he wouldn't have been around this long. Up next, Michael Cremo joins us as we talk about the Darwinian theory, alternative theories of human origins, and new evidence against the theory of evolution. Michael Cremo next on Coast to Coast AM. Here he is now, Michael Cremo, expert in archaeological evidence for alternative theories of human origins and is a research associate in history and philosophy of science. You know, after he received his scholarship, Michael began to study the ancient theories of India and broadened his academic knowledge with spirituality from the Eastern tradition. He writes a column titled The Forbidden Archaeologist for Atlantis Rising. He's appeared on numerous programs, including a regular here on Coast to Coast, Michael Cremo. Hey, Michael, how are you?
I'm doing really great. I just got back from a six-week lecture tour of India, and I'm back here in L.A. now, and I was really looking forward to talking to you tonight.
This is going to be super. You can update us on that trip as well. 200 years, the anniversary of Charles Darwin. Amazing, isn't it?
Well, yes, it is. And, you know, I mean, some friends of mine from India, they tell me kind of jokingly that maybe I'm a reincarnation of Charles Darwin, and you know, I've had to take birth again to correct my mistake. I laughed when I first heard that, too, but sometimes I wonder about it.
Michael, when you and I started talking way gone back, we were talking about your work with forbidden archaeology, which then evolved into human devolution as well and some of your other works. Give us an overview. Give us the capsule version of forbidden archaeology.
Forbidden archaeology presents archaeological evidence that contradicts the Darwinian theory of human evolution. According to what the evolutionists tell us, humans like us came into existence about 150,000 years ago. And before that, they say, there were no humans like us. There were only various more primitive ape-like human ancestors like Homo erectus, Homo habilis, Australopithecus, and so on. So they say all the physical evidence supports that idea, but what I showed in Forbidden Archaeology was is if that you go beyond the textbooks, if you go digging into the primary scientific literature, and by that I mean original reports by archaeologists, anthropologists, geologists, and other earth scientists published in the scientific professional literature, you will find hundreds of reports of evidence for extreme human antiquity, human bones, human artifacts, human footprints, going back many millions of years, right back to the very beginnings of the history of life on Earth. So it's not true that all of the physical evidence supports the current evolutionary theories of human origins, which say humans like us first came into existence only about 150,000 years ago. There are hundreds of scientific reports that show humans like us have existed for far longer periods of time on Earth. And this evidence is screened out of the textbooks by what I call a process of knowledge filtration. You know, evidence that supports the current theories of human evolution will be found in the textbooks. It will be talked about by scientists. But evidence that radically contradicts the current theories is filtered out. You won't see it in the textbooks. You won't hear scientists talking about it very much. You won't hear very much about it at all unless you tune into a show like this. So that's why I called this book Forbidden Archaeology, because somehow or other, this evidence for extreme human antiquity has been forbidden by the controllers of the mainstream scientific organizations who control what goes into the textbooks and the education system.
And human devolution was an offshoot of that then, right?
Yes, that's correct, George. After people, scientists and other people, read Forbidden Archaeology, they communicated with me. They said, Well, you've presented all of this archaeological evidence that contradicts the current theories of human origins. So what are you going to put in its place? So my book, Human Devolution, A Vedic Alternative to Darwin's Theory, is my answer to that question. And what I first ask is, I think we should, before we even ask the question, where did human beings come from, we should first of all ask the question, what is a human being? Now, today, many scientists are going to say a human being or any other living thing is just a complex organization of the ordinary material elements, the chemical elements like iron, calcium, phosphorus, etc. But what I propose in this book, Human Devolution, is that if we look carefully at all the evidence that science presents us, we will see it's more reasonable to say that a human being is made of three things. Ordinary matter, yes, that's part of what a human being is, but beyond that, there is a subtle mind element that has some very unusual powers like extrasensory perception, telekinesis, and things like that. And then beyond that subtle mind element, there is the element of consciousness. There's a conscious self that can exist apart from the body, apart from matter. And what I'm proposing is that we don't evolve up from matter. You know, as conscious beings, we don't evolve up from matter, as many scientists now say. I believe we are originally conscious beings who have simply become covered by matter temporarily.
Yesterday, we reported on Zahi Hawass, Egypt's antiquities head, talking about the possibility that they might have found the area and maybe the tombs of Mark Anthony and Cleopatra. And I'm thinking, Michael, that you're going to be on the program the next day. And I'm saying, man, we're talking about things that happened way before that. And I can understand the excitement by Zahi if they find it, what a discovery that will be. But can you imagine humankind around here millions and millions and millions, and in some cases 100 million years ago? There's a documentary floating around on cable right now about buildings, which answers part of why I think you could very well be correct, Michael, and that is, what happened to their structures? What happened to their buildings if they existed, and maybe they had technology? We'll get into that too. But according to this documentary, if you left a skyscraper alone for a number of years, let's say 1,000, it would totally disintegrate to dust. It would be gone. And, you know, that could explain partially why there's really no remnants of these past civilizations.
Well, it's not that there's no remnants, but you're correct. A lot of the stuff that we consider significant in our modern technological civilization would not last very long if we take into account the kinds of studies that you just mentioned. These studies have come into existence today, and maybe this ties in a little bit with Earth Day coming up tomorrow. Some scientists wonder what would be the impact if humans just disappeared from the Earth today. How long would the remains of our civilization last? And what they've concluded is that over vast periods of time, it wouldn't last very long. As you mentioned, skyscrapers, most of them have steel beam construction. After some time, those steel beams are going to oxidize. They're going to rust. And as metal rusts, it expands. And that means it will crack the concrete, which will fall off. And then another thing we have to consider is that most of our cities are built on the edges of oceans or lakes or rivers, and they depend on very elaborate systems of dams and water control systems, which if humans disappeared, would no longer be maintained. So many of our cities would be flooded. Fires would burn unrestricted. So that means a lot is going to be destroyed, but not everything. For example, in forbidden archaeology, in one of the more extreme cases that I included in that book, I encountered a report from Heavener, Oklahoma, early in the 20th century, where miners had gone about 2 miles deep into a coal mine in Oklahoma, and they were using dynamite to blast out the coal. They would use dynamite to blast out what they call a room, you know, deep under the earth, and then they would clear the coal, you know, from the room, and then they do another blast, make another room, clear the coal from that. So after they had finished blasting what they call a room, very deep in this coal mine, they found at the end of it a wall made of 6-inch square polished blocks of stone, and the stone was so polished that they could see their reflections in it. It appeared to be a wall, a part of the building. And what's really amazing is that at that level, we're talking about coal deposits about 300 million years old. So, so sometimes we do get reports of architectural structures in very ancient layers of rock, but they're not very common, and I think one of the reasons why they're not common is that this sort of thing doesn't usually preserve very well over these vast expanses of time. Sometimes people ask me, why is much of the evidence in your book in the form of stone tools and weapons? Why don't we find laptop computers, for example, in layers of rock?
And TVs and things
like TVs, that. You know, and layers of rock 100 million years old. Well, we have to consider, well, what's going to happen to a TV or a laptop over the course of many, many millions of years? The metals will all oxidize, except gold. That's one reason why we consider gold to be very valuable. It doesn't oxidize very easily. And it is a fact that among the metal objects that are encountered in very ancient layers of rock are gold objects. For example, a gold chain found in a piece of coal about 300 million years old in the state of Illinois. That's a case I mention in my book. But let's go back to the computers and the TVs. Let's assume that you've got a situation where you've got some people, as today, still using stone tools and things like that. You've got other people using more advanced technologies like televisions and computers. Well, what's going to be left after 100 million years? The stone tools are still going to be there because they preserve very well over many millions of years, but a TV or a computer isn't going to preserve very well over those vast periods of time because the plastics, for example, will corrode and dissolve. You know, I just saw a report in a scientific journal about how difficult museums are, what a difficult time museums are having preserving plastic objects. You know, they're trying to preserve, you know, the different things made out of plastic that have been made over the past 100 years, and they're finding it's very hard because the plastic is turning to dust. It dissolves, it corrodes, it disintegrates.
And there's nothing they really can do about it.
And the minerals, you know, the metals, they tend to oxidize. So the kinds of things that we consider typical of a high-tech civilization don't preserve very well over vast periods of time, whereas other kinds of implements, like stone tools and things like that, will preserve. But even those stone tools, they are evidence of a human presence just as much as a computer or a television is.
Michael, do you think, though, let's say the pyramids, do you think in 100,000 years the pyramids will probably just turn into dust?
No, I don't think so. Those who have studied this, you know, probably in the same kind of documentary that you were talking about, mentioned that these monumental stone objects constructions like the pyramids, they will last over vast periods of time, whereas our steel and glass types of buildings, they won't.
They won't.
They won't. So we I think we have to ask who's really more advanced.
And the big question, too, now is did we have advanced civilizations technologically millions and millions of years ago, or was it primitive? Maybe there were never computers and flat-screen TVs then.
Well, there are two kinds of evidence about the past, George. One is what we can find in the layers of the Earth, and the other is what we find in the records left by various ancient civilizations. For example, the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, in particular the Puranas or the histories, tell of human civilizations that existed millions of years ago that had, for example, spacecraft, Vimanas, they were called. And these were capable of traveling from one planet to another on our dimension, and it appears they were also capable of interdimensional travel, just going to from our level of reality to completely other different levels of reality, kind of like in Star Trek when they go into sometimes they would go into these black holes or wormholes or something and come out in some completely different level of reality. I think that's also possible. So if we look at the records of some of these ancient civilizations like the Sumerians, the Egyptians, the Chinese, and others, we do see indications that in very ancient times they had what we would consider to be advanced technologies and advanced scientific knowledge. I'm most familiar with the ancient Sanskrit writings of India. That's what I've studied very deeply. For example, I was just reading the other day as a passage in the Puranas that explained how to calculate time by the movement of atoms. So atomic clocks are something that we consider our modern technological civilization invented just within the past 100 years. But according to these ancient Sanskrit writings, millions of years ago, their equivalent of scientists had the same abilities to calculate time according to the movement of atoms, to travel to different planets in spaceships. There are also descriptions of weapons very much resembling modern atomic weapons. They were called Brahmastras. And it's interesting that the head of the American Manhattan Project that developed the American atomic bomb during World War II, Dr. Robert Oppenheimer, was also a student of the ancient Sanskrit literature, and he was aware of these things. And when he exploded, when the Manhattan Project exploded the first test atomic weapon at Alamogordo in New Mexico, he was present there, and when he saw the flash of light, he began quoting Sanskrit verses about a light greater than millions of suns, you know, which is a perfect description of an atomic bomb explosion. So if we look into the records left by some of these ancient civilizations, and I would say Eric von Daniken did some interesting work.
Let's pick it up right from there when we come back. Michael Cremo, our special guest, noted author, Human Devolution, Forbidden Archaeology. More with Michael on Coast to Coast AM. Michael Cremo, our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Michael, we were talking about Eric von Daniken. I'll let you pick up from there.
Well, I think he did a good job in documenting some of the architectural evidence, you know, stone carvings and things like that that appear to show signs of advanced technology existing in ancient civilizations, perhaps not as far back in time as I'm dealing with, millions of years, but certainly before, you know, in times before most scientists believe that such developments were possible, going back to, you know, the classical civilizations of ancient Egypt, and South American classical civilizations like the Incas and the Aztecs and things like that. So I thought he did a good job of that. Of course, even that got him in huge trouble with the academic world. But I've got to admire somebody who caused such a reaction among these mainstream academics. And recently there was a show on, I guess it was the History Channel, Ancient Aliens.
Right. I was on it.
Yeah, that Giorgio Tsoukalos was a consulting producer for. I was on it, too.
Yeah,
and
sure was. You had a great job on it, by the way.
Yeah, I was kind of happy to participate in that because I mean, people may have different opinions about Eric von Däniken, but I think he opened up a whole area of investigation. Actually, I've met many professional archaeologists who, although they don't agree with him, they say that it was his book, you know, Chariot of the Gods, that got them interested in archaeology, which I think is a fantastic thing.
Now, Michael, let's assume for a moment that there were past civilizations of millions of years ago. We're going to get into the dinosaurs and how they may have coexisted, but it had a high technological life. Do you think it's conceivable they could have left this planet? They could have gone to the moon, for example. There could be artifacts on the moon that we left behind?
Well, yes, I think this is a distinct possibility because as I was mentioning earlier, the records of these ancient civilizations speak of space travel, visitations by extraterrestrials coming to this planet. There are accounts of humans from this planet going to other planets and to even higher dimensions of the cosmos. So I think that's a distinct possibility. And it may seem to some people a bit strange and beyond the limits of science. But, you know, I'm a member of the World Archaeological Congress, which is the world's largest international organization of archaeologists. And every 4 years, they hold a congress in a different city in the world. And in the past two congresses, held in Washington in 1995 and in Dublin last year, I mean 2005 in Washington and last year in Dublin, there were sections in this conference of professional archaeologists dealing with extraterrestrial archaeology, dealing with, of course, the idea that someday archaeologists are going to go to the moon and to Mars and places like that, where we've already sent probes. I mean, we've sent satellites that have landed on the moon, that have landed on Mars and other planets in our solar system. So they're already thinking, well, who is that stuff going to belong to? What museum is it going to go into when it's collected by archaeologists? So they're already thinking about these issues, and they're also thinking not just about things that we may have left on these other planets, but things that may have come from outside our solar system by other intelligences elsewhere in the universe. They're expecting to find things like that as well, and they're already discussing different kinds of laws and things that will govern who will own these things, what museum they'll go into, things like that. So to some people, it may seem very strange to talk about these things, but even among professional archaeologists, they're already talking about these things. Of course, they're talking about things they know we've sent in recent decades, but I would say, as you were suggesting, they might also expect to find, or maybe they will be very surprised to find, evidence of previous visitations to these planets by humans like us.
That would be remarkable. Truly remarkable, wouldn't it?
I think it would, and I really expect that those things are going to be found. Because,
what?
As I said, there are two records of the past. One is what we can find in the layers of rocks on this planet and other planets, and the other is what we can find in the records left by these ancient civilizations. And in the records of these ancient civilizations, there are definite indications of interplanetary travel by humans. And I think we should expect to find confirming evidence for that when we actually venture out ourselves into these realms again.
What do you think happened to them, Michael, to the old ancient civilization?
What I think is that time goes in vast cycles, and at certain points in the cycles, human civilizations rise to some very high level of development, either in terms of their knowledge or spiritual advancement or technological advancement, and then there are periods of decline when the earlier knowledge is temporarily lost, but the time cycles will continue, and the lost knowledge can be recovered in these times of ascent. So this is something that the Greek philosophers understood. If you go back to the time of Plato and Aristotle, they talked about human civilizations that have risen and fallen many times in the course of vast periods of the Earth's history. And this is also something that's part of, well, the Mayan calendar, for example. The Mayan calendar deals with vast periods of cyclical time going back millions and millions of years. And at certain points in the cycle, things are on the upswing, and during other parts of the cycle, things are in decline. Many people are looking forward to 2012 on this basis, wondering what's going to happen then. So I see a pattern like that. Civilizations rising and falling over vast courses of cyclical time.
I think so, too. Indeed. Now, let's get into some of the most recent evidence of anything new. Any new discoveries out here?
Well, there's been some interesting reports coming out of Kenya over the past couple of months. It's attracted a lot of media attention. Scientists working near Lake Turkana at a place called Ileret in Kenya, which is in East Africa, have discovered footprints. Now, it's interesting how they interpret these footprints. They're found in layers of rock about 1.5 million years old. But they also note the footprints are exactly like modern human footprints. They're like the footprints an anatomically modern human being would make. But the scientists who are reporting this, they don't believe that humans like us were actually present 1.5 million years ago. They're evolutionists. They believe humans like us first came into existence 150,000 years ago. So to have the idea that humans like us could be existing 10 times further back in time, 1.5 million years instead of 150,000 years, is something that they're not prepared to consider. So what they do is they try to make this evidence fit into their current picture of the evolutionary history of human beings by saying, okay, who was around at that time? What kind of ape man was present at that time? There was an ape man called Homo erectus,
right,
who was present at that time. So they say, well, obviously, this Homo erectus ape man must have had feet just like modern human feet. Now, nobody's ever really shown that. Nobody's ever discovered the foot skeleton of a Homo erectus. So we really don't know what the foot of this Homo erectus looked like. Actually, the only creature known to science today that has a foot structure exactly like that of a modern human being is a human being like us. So, I would say the proper scientific thing to do with this evidence is to say, well, here we've got evidence that human beings like us were existing 1.5 million years ago. People often ask me, are scientists continuing to discover evidence of the kind that you talk about in forbidden archaeology? And the answer is yes, they are discovering such evidence all over the world right up to the present moment. And this case from Kenya, the Illiret footprints, is a perfect example of how this knowledge filtering process works. The evidence is staring them right in the face. The footprints are there. They're 1.5 million years old. The footprints are exactly like modern human footprints. But rather than making the obvious conclusion that humans like us made those footprints 1.5 million years ago, they try to fit it in somehow or other to their current way of thinking. And the way they do that is by saying, yes, there must have been some kind of ape man who had feet exactly like modern human feet, when there's no evidence for that whatsoever.
Do you think, Michael, most scientists would be apt to defend Darwin or challenge him?
Most professional scientists today would be inclined to defend the Darwinian theory of evolution, and there's proof of this. Now, one thing to consider is, however, that most people do not accept the Darwinian theory of evolution. For example, in the United States, the Gallup survey has examined the beliefs of the American people about evolution. They find only about 10% of the American people actually accept the Darwinian theory of evolution as it's taught by the scientists in the education system. And I think this is really pretty amazing. About 50% of the American people believe that God made human beings just like us in the beginning, which is something I also believe. And I believe, not I just believe it, I believe there's evidence to show that. You know, the book Forbidden Archaeology is packed with hundreds of cases showing that humans like us have continuously existed on this planet from the present all the way back to the very beginnings of the history of life on Earth. So it's not that it's just some belief that I happen to like. I believe there's physical evidence that supports what I believe. And actually, most of the American people, over 50% of them, would agree with me on that point. There are about 30% who believe that there was evolution of the kind that Darwin talked about, but God guided it to produce human beings like us about 150,000 years ago. There's two reasons I don't like that idea very much. It's a compromise many people try to make between science and religion. They want to have their cake and eat it too. So,
sure.
But the reason I don't like that particular compromise is you can find a lot of physical evidence that contradicts it, as I said. In Forbidden Archaeology, I've documented this evidence showing that humans like us have existed for far more than the 150,000 years that the Darwinists allow. And second, if you look at any of the spiritual texts of any of the world's great religions, we never find any account that, well, God first created monkeys and then he turned them into human beings. It's just not there. So that's the reason I personally don't like that compromise very much. But the point is that 80% of the American people do not accept the Darwinian theory of evolution. Only about 10% really do accept it in the form that it's taught, you know, in the education system. And there are 10% who just don't care. And maybe they're the most intelligent, I don't know.
Well, what is science afraid of, Michael? Why don't they simply say, you know what, it's conceivable that mankind lived hundreds of millions of years ago, that they might have had advanced technologies, something horrible happened to them, and it may have happened 20 times since where we are now.
I think that would be the most reasonable thing to actually do. But the problem is now the Darwinists have a government-enforced monopoly in our education system. No alternatives are actually allowed in the science classroom. And I think this is something that eventually is going to change. You can't have the vast majority of people believing one thing and a few scientists believing another thing and then trying to impose it on everybody through their government-enforced monopoly in the education system. I don't think that's something that can go on for too much longer. I think the proper solution is to allow some alternatives in the textbooks. I would say, yeah, let the Darwinian theory of evolution remain in the textbooks, but there should be some small section of the textbooks, at least, I would say about 5% of the textbooks, should include alternatives to the current theories of human origins, and it should be presented in a neutral and objective way, and just let students make up their own minds about, you know, these important questions. And I think this is better than the current system of complete exclusion of the alternatives from the science curriculum in the public schools for two reasons. First of all, what I'm proposing reflects the actual realities in the scientific world today, namely that most scientists accept, you know, the Darwinian theory of evolution, but there's a minority who don't and who are proposing alternatives. So what I'm proposing is very realistic. The current policy of complete exclusion of the alternatives is very artificial because it doesn't reflect the realities in the scientific world today that, yes, the majority of scientists accept the Darwinian theory of evolution, but there's a minority who don't. And I believe those minority views should be represented in the curriculum. And another thing, I believe what I'm proposing respects academic freedom. I mean, many scientists today, they like to talk about Galileo. They say, yes, Galileo, he had some new idea about the solar system several centuries ago. But the church, because of its influence with the political system and the governments of the time, was able to effectively suppress his views. But now, when the supporters of the theory of evolution are in the same position, having influence over the judicial system and the systems for defining what goes into the textbooks and the science curriculum, they're using their influence to do the same thing that the church did to Galileo several centuries ago. They are using their influence to exclude alternative views. And so I think we need a little diversity in the science curriculum. We need to trust people to make their own choices. We don't need to dictate to people only one idea.
And, Michael, you believe that dinosaurs and humans coexisted. We'll talk about that when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Michael, what kind of dinosaurs do you think coexisted with humans at the time?
Well, it depends what we mean by dinosaurs. I mean, today, most scientists believe that birds and crocodiles and alligators are direct members of the dinosaur family. So those were around. But if we're talking about the classic dinosaurs that people think about, that we find in films like Jurassic Park,
right,
and its different offspring.
The raptors and the T-Rexes.
Yeah, those, the Tyrannosaurus Rex, the Brontosaurus, those sorts of dinosaurs. They existed between the Triassic period, which goes back about 230 million years, and the Cretaceous period, which goes back to around 65 million years. So during that period of time, that is when the classic dinosaurs existed. However, in Forbidden Archaeology, my book Forbidden Archaeology, I've shown that humans like us also existed during that time, before the time of the classic dinosaurs, during the time of the classic dinosaurs, and after the time of the classic dinosaurs. There's a very interesting case from a place called the Paluxy River in Texas, where there were reports of human footprints alongside dinosaur footprints. And I learned about those footprints when I was doing research for my book, Forbidden Archaeology, but I did not include that case in the book for this reason. The human footprints alongside the dinosaur footprints were originally reported by a Christian creationist researcher named Henry Morris, Jr. Okay. And I looked at the case very extensively, and I found that he later withdrew his claims in a letter published in Nature, which is a scientific journal. This Dr. Henry Morris said, "I was mistaken. What I thought were human footprints actually are not human footprints. They are dinosaur footprints that were eroded to look like human footprints." So on that basis, I felt I can't include this as evidence for humans coexisting with dinosaurs. But I kept the case in my files, and then later on, an archaeology student from Texas got in touch with me and asked, "Can I help you with your research in any way?" And I said, "I would like you to do this. I would like you to go to Paluxy and have a look at those footprints and tell me what you think as a professional archaeologist." And the student went there, a graduate student, not just a beginning student, but a graduate student in archaeology, went there and actually participated in some new excavations. And on the basis of what she told me, she said new footprints were uncovered there. They looked totally human. And on the basis of her reports, on-the-scene reports, I've decided that there are genuine human footprints alongside dinosaur footprints at this place on the Paluxy River in Texas. And in a new book, which I'm writing now, which I'm calling Forbidden Archaeology 2, which includes cases that have come to my attention since the first book was published, I'm going to include that particular case as evidence suggesting that humans like us existed alongside these classic dinosaurs of the kind that, you know, we see in so many films. So, but even before the time of the dinosaurs, there's evidence that humans were present. For example, in the year 1862, a scientific journal called The Geologist published an interesting report. A human skeleton, an anatomically modern human skeleton, was found 90 feet below the surface of the ground in Macoupin County in the state of Illinois in America.
Right.
And directly above the skeleton was a thick layer of slate rock that extended for hundreds of yards in all directions. That's an important detail because many times when people hear about a discovery like this, they'll say, "Well, isn't it possible that the skeleton could have come down through some fissure from some more recent level to this very ancient layer of rock, or maybe it was buried there or something?" But the presence of this thick, unbroken layer of slate rock above the skeleton rules out those kinds of possibilities. It indicates the skeleton really does belong in the layer in which it was found, which in this case, according to modern geologists of the state of Illinois, is about 300 million years. So that's from before the time of the dinosaurs. There's evidence that humans were present before the time of the dinosaurs, during the time of the dinosaurs, and even after, of course, after. But I would say immediately after the extinction of the classic dinosaurs at the end of the Cretaceous period, most scientists now believe that some asteroid or comet struck the Earth at that point, and there was a huge devastation that resulted in the extinction of the dinosaurs. But some of them actually survived. As I mentioned, alligators and crocodiles are members of the dinosaur family.
Sure.
And they're still with us today. I grew up in Florida, and it was very common Even in cities sometimes, a family would go down for a picnic near some nice-looking lake or stream, and the family dog or sometimes even a child would be down by the water, and out comes the alligator and takes it away. We're coexisting with large, dangerous reptiles on this planet even today. So even today we're coexisting with big, dangerous members of the dinosaur family. So if we're doing that today, I don't see any reason why humans like us could not have been coexisting with them many millions of years ago during the time that the classic dinosaurs are supposed to have existed, from the Triassic to the Cretaceous periods, from about 230 million to about 65 million years ago. Of course, this will take us into an area called cryptozoology.
Right.
But there are reports from various parts of the world, including the Amazon and the Congo, that perhaps some few of the classic dinosaurs are still with us today. There are reports to that effect from the field of cryptozoology.
Sure. There aren't many, but there could be. They could be out there.
Right. But these other members of the dinosaur family, like the crocodiles and the alligators, they're extremely numerous. There's also the Komodo dragon, which is a huge lizard-like animal that exists on an island in the Pacific. And sometimes we find them kept in zoos. For example, in Los Angeles, they had Komodo dragon. And the Los Angeles Zoo had a policy of letting donors, big donors, come in after hours for special tours. And I read one report where some donor and his wife had come to the zoo after hours, and they wanted to see the Komodo dragon. So they asked to be allowed into their enclosure.
Oh.
So they did that, and the man, his foot got bitten by a Komodo dragon. And actually, you can do nature tours of this Komodo island in the Pacific, and you have to be very careful because, you're going through this tall grass, and these animals, these Komodo dragons, they will attack humans.
Well, there was a guy just several weeks ago up in a tree on that island. He fell out of the tree, and one of the Komodo dragons got him and killed him.
Yeah, so my point is we're coexisting with relatives of the dinosaurs even today on this planet. So if we're coexisting today, I believe we were also coexisting with these creatures in the past. And generally, we see different types of animals. They tend to stick to their own habitats. For example, the crocodiles and the alligators, they have their habitat, the swamps. And humans are generally, most humans are generally not living directly in the swamps, directly alongside the crocodiles and alligators. They're living in other habitats, other parts of the environment. So just as we manage to kind of keep ourselves and different kinds of dangerous animals in different areas of the environment, I believe the same was also true in the past.
Tell me the incredible story, Michael, that you've told me several times about those metal balls that were found deep underground and, that shape. They just look like they were made by someone.
Well, this is one of the more extreme anomalies that I documented in my book, Forbidden Archaeology. I mean, the story is this. Miners in South Africa, in the Western Transvaal region at a place called Ottosdal, have found many hundreds of these objects in a mine there. They're round metallic objects. I call them metallic because they're made out of hematite, which is a kind of iron, naturally occurring type of iron. And hematite is considered to be a semi-precious stone. You can buy jewelry made of hematite, for example. It's a fairly hard mineral, kind of iron ore. And what was really interesting about these objects, which are about 1 or 2 inches in diameter, is that they have these parallel grooves that go around the center. They're spherical. They're round. And many of them have these parallel grooves that go around the center of each object. Sometimes they have just one of these grooves, but many of them have more. They have 2 or 3, and they're parallel. And I once gave these things to a producer who was producing a documentary for the NBC television network. The documentary was called The Mysterious Origins of Man. The producer was Bill Cote of New York. He was interested in including some of the cases from my book, Forbidden Archaeology, in this documentary. So I had some samples of these objects, and I gave them to him. And NBC told him, as producer, that they would not air images of these unless he submitted them to an independent company of metallurgists who would examine them. So he did that. Through an archaeologist he knew, he submitted these round metal objects, metallic objects from South Africa to an independent company of metallurgists in the United States, and they examined them, and they said they could not explain how these things could have formed naturally in the layers of the earth, because that's the usual counter-explanation. These are just natural objects. But this independent company of metallurgists said they could not explain how these things could have formed naturally in the layers of the earth, in particular the parallel grooves that go around the center of each object. Now, what's really interesting is that these things are found solidly embedded and mineral deposits that are over 2 billion years old.
Jeez.
Which goes back to the very beginnings of the history of life on Earth, because that's when most scientists today think that life began on Earth, between 2 and 3 billion years ago. So, most scientists believe that only the most simple, unintelligent forms of life were present at that time, but these objects appear to have been manufactured by someone with human-like intelligence at those very, very early times. And sometimes people will say, well, maybe, you know, what proof do you have that they really are solidly embedded in these mineral deposits? Well, I went to South Africa. I met with the chief mining engineer from the mine from which these objects come, and he showed me a huge block of mineral from the mine with these round objects embedded in the mineral, like raisins, you know, in a piece of dough or something. Some of them were protruding halfway out of the rock, you know, so that half of the surface was exposed. And on those specimens that were protruding out of the rock partially, they had the grooves. You could see the grooves on the exposed portions of the spheres going back into the solid rock. Those are some details that I think rule out the possibility, well, maybe somebody just took some round objects and engraved some grooves in them. That possibility was ruled out by the metallurgists who looked at the grooves on these spheres through electron microscopes, and they said, Nobody could have recently carved these things in there because they could detect no traces of, you know, microscopic flecks of metal. You know, like if you'd used a dentist drill, for example, to engrave the grooves on, it would have left microscopic flakes of metal from the drill. And the metallurgists who looked at the grooves under an electron microscope could detect no such signs.
Michael,
interesting. They're just really mysterious. Maybe somebody will in the future be able to prove how they were formed naturally, but at the present moment, I think we have to consider them as evidence that intelligent beings like us were present in those very ancient times.
Do you think one day someone will stumble across an underground city that may have been built hundreds of millions of years ago, or millions of years ago?
I can't personally, I cannot rule out that possibility. It is completely within the realm of possibility. And I mentioned earlier in the show some signs that maybe perhaps some of these things have already been discovered, like that stone wall in the coal mine in Hebner, Oklahoma. I think it's possible that more things like this, perhaps more extensive kinds of remains, may be discovered, or maybe they're underwater now because the sea levels have been rising for the past several hundred thousand years. So perhaps some of these things may be found underwater, not just underground, but underwater.
And in pretty good shape, I would assume, if they're underwater.
Yes, there have been some cases, not so old, but predating the origin of cities, according to the standard accounts. For example, in the Gulf of Cambay, off the coast of northwestern India, in the Gujarat state, there were some Indian oceanographers who were doing underwater surveys with sonar, and they found cities underwater there that appear to be at least 10,000 years old. Now, that's not as old as I like to deal with, but it's definitely older than most archaeologists believe that cities should be. So there already are some tantalizing hints of these things, and I believe that future generations of researchers who may have more open minds than many researchers today may encounter these things and not simply try to explain them away, but accept them for what they are and actually report them to us.
When we come back, let's talk about the Vedas, the year 2012, and also I'd like you to paint us a picture, Michael, of this nuclear war that may have occurred millions of years ago. Tell us what you think happened. We'll be back. Michael's book, Human Devolution, is available. There's a toll-free number for you, 1-800-443-3361. That's 1-800-443-3361. His website, there are several, mcremo.com, and then humandevolution.com, and forbiddenarchaeology.com. Next hour, we'll have phone calls with Michael. We'll come back more, though, and chat on Coast to Coast AM. Michael, kind of paint us a story here of what you believed happened millions of years ago. Kind of speculate on how far back and what happened to civilizations again.
Well, as I said earlier in the show, George, I believe time goes in vast cycles, just like in the temperate countries, you get seasons. You know, first there's the spring, then there's the summer, then there's the fall, then there's the winter, and then the spring comes again. Life regenerates, it matures. It then in the fall it begins to decline, in the winter it goes dormant. So I believe that civilizations go through this same cycle. They come into existence, they mature, then they dwindle, and then they go into a state of dormancy, and then they revive again. So there are accounts like this in the ancient Sanskrit writings of India that explain there's a cycle of ages, of four ages. The first is kind of a golden, very natural age called the Satya Yuga, the age of truth, when the conditions all over the earth, the environmental conditions, are very paradisical, sort of like Hawaii-like climate and environment all over the earth. And it's also an age in which people are very interested in pursuing spiritual truth, living as simply and naturally as possible, living in a very healthy state with very long lives and very highly developed mental and emotional and intellectual powers. And then in the next age, which is called the Treta Yuga, things begin to get a little more selfishness enters mm-hmm. into the human consciousness, and there's more attention to exploiting and dominating and controlling the material resources. So this is when cities develop and class-structured societies and governments and things like that come into existence, and you start getting this element of conflict and environmental exploitation entering into the picture. And then in the next age, things get a little bit worse. And then finally, there's the age of Kali, which is the age we're in, where these things exist in very extreme forms. People right. become very short-lived. The governments become very exploitative. There's a lot of greed and selfishness and economic exploitation and conflict. And
it's magnified, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And during these times, eventually, according to the predictions, and this has happened in the past, what we do is we destroy our environment. And finally, there's people are reduced to cannibalism. Because they've destroyed all their food sources and things like that. And then finally there's just a devastation that brings it all to a close. But it's interesting, according to these accounts, there are refuges, what we might call sacred refuges, in like the Himalayan mountains and things like that, where there are good people who are remaining hidden, so that when the next golden age begins, the next mm-hmm. Satyayuga begins, they'll emerge from these refuges, they'll repopulate the earth, and the whole cycle will go again. So in the early parts of these cycles, things are very natural. People are living very simply, very naturally. They're living in harmony with nature, with each other, with the higher forces in the cosmos. They're very elevated in terms of their consciousness, their emotional development, their intellectual development. But then the seed of selfishness enters, the greed enters, and then gradually we wind up in a situation much like the one that we see ourselves now in. We're now in the Kali Yuga, the age of quarrel and hypocrisy and materialism. But, I mean, just because it's raining, it doesn't mean you have to get wet. Just because the trend is in that direction, it doesn't mean any individual person has to go along with the trend. You can resist it. You can try to protect yourself, protect others.
Seems like history repeats itself.
Yeah,
Michael.
So I think that's where we are now. We're in one of the downturns, but eventually things will go back up again. But even during the downturn, for example, like when the winter season's coming on, it doesn't mean you have to become a victim of the winter season. You don't have to starve and freeze. You can take steps to protect yourself. So even though things may be in this downturn, it's possible for people individually and collectively to protect themselves, and I believe people are doing that. And also, just as we see when winter's coming on, there may be some warm days, some Indian summer, it's called. We should take advantage of those times, which I think are, I think we're in one of those times right now, where although the general trend is down, we're in a little bit of an upswing at the present moment, where many people are becoming more spiritually aware, and it's possible during these times where there's an upswing in the middle of a downward trend to really prepare yourself for what's going to come.
Michael, do you factor in here also Earth catastrophes, perhaps an asteroid hit, a solar flare wipe them out, or something like that? Not yeah. man-made?
Yes, I do see something like that. If we look at what the Puranas tell us about the whole history of life on Earth, we see that according to the Puranas, there are even larger time cycles than the Yugas. The Yugas are a Yuga cycle lasts about 4 million years, but there are larger cycles called Manvantars that last about 300 million years. And according to the Vedic cosmological calendar, we're now in the seventh Manvantar period in terms of the whole history of life on Earth. And after each Manvantar period, it said there's a devastation, a huge devastation, after which the Earth has to be repopulated and civilization has to be restored. And it's interesting, according to modern paleontology, in the history of life on Earth, there have been six major extinction events, major environmental catastrophes, the last one being the one that wiped out the dinosaurs about 65 million years ago. They believe there was a huge environmental catastrophe that was set off by some asteroid or comet striking the Earth. So yes, there is a place in my thinking for huge environmental catastrophes. And even in terms of the shorter Yuga cycles, there are descriptions in the Puranas saying that as the Kali Yuga progresses, things are going to get warmer, hotter, and there are going to be extremes of heat and cold. And this is what we find. You know, like we see, yes, there's evidence for global warming, but we also see that some parts of the world have experienced extreme cold. For example, last winter was extremely cold in the northeast U.S.
Some people think we're in the beginning stages of an ice age.
Yes, that's what I mean. So both things, this is really consistent with what the Vedas say. They say there are going to be extremes of heat and cold as the Kali Yuga goes on. But eventually, it's the heat is going to win out. And there's going to be desertification. And we actually see this in various parts of the world. There's a lot of deforestation and desertification going on in Africa, in Asia, to some extent in South America and even North America. Deforestation is going on. Desertification is going on. By desertification, I mean the desert areas are expanding. So that trend is going to continue, you know, according to what these Vedic writings tell us. And in the end, it's going to be extremely hot. And you mentioned solar flares. Something that's mentioned in the ancient Sanskrit writings is that in terms of the larger cycles that I was talking about, that at the end, it's the sun, energy is going to be so intense that it's going to be very hard for life to survive on Earth. So, yes, there is room for environmental catastrophes in what I'm proposing, what I believe is going to be happening.
Explain the Vedas for us, Michael. Exactly what are they?
Veda is a Sanskrit word that means knowledge. Just like when you get a new computer or a new automobile, you get an owner's manual that gives you the knowledge necessary to operate your vehicle, maintain it, and understand what the purpose and the capabilities of the vehicle are.
Of which few people read, by the way.
Right, unfortunately, and therefore they're not able to use whatever they've got to its best purposes. So, along with the universe, along with the human form of life, there comes a manual. And the Vedas, they propose themselves as being that manual containing the knowledge that we need, first of all, to understand who we are, where we came from, what we should be doing. And in addition to that, there's knowledge about how to manage our affairs in the most simple, natural, and efficient way possible. Because according to the Vedas, we're not originally from this level of reality. We are beings of pure consciousness who have come from some higher level of the cosmos, a level of pure consciousness where we exist in harmony with the source of all conscious beings, with other conscious beings, Only those conscious selves who become selfish or egotistical come down to the level of reality where we are now. And our purpose of life should be to restore consciousness to its original pure state, which means we should be living our lives on the material level of reality in the most simple, natural, and efficient way possible, while putting most of our human energy into elevating consciousness back to its original pure state. And yeah, there are different systems of yoga, meditation, prayer, contemplation that the world's great cultures have for doing this. But as you say, many people just aren't going to pay any attention to that. They just accept the situation they're in, and generally because they're not aware of, you could say, the owner's manual for the human form of life and the universe, they mess things up.
Yes.
Unfortunately.
Unfortunately.
But so the Vedas, they contain this esoteric spiritual knowledge, but they also contain information about how to live in this world in the most simple, natural, and efficient way possible. For example, there's a system of medicine described in the Ayurveda, which is based on natural cures, herbal remedies, understanding how the body is really put together in a way that modern medicine really doesn't understand. There's also information about how society could be properly organized. There's all kinds of information in the Vedas about architecture, art, culture, economics, medicine, government, all of these things. So I think it's, and of course, this information is not just exclusive to the Vedas. There are other great wisdom traditions of the world which also contain similar information. And I think one of the problems with our modern society is that we've cut ourselves off from these timeless sources of wisdom, and we're trying to make our own way out of this jungle, and we're not doing a very good job of it.
No, not at all. Do the Vedas talk about 2012?
Not specifically. 2012 comes from another cultural system. It comes from the Mayan cultural system. It's based on studies that people have made of the Mayan calendar, which also talks of vast cycles of time. And according to the Mayans themselves and other researchers, the year 2012 marks the end of one of these cycles. But there's a lot of different opinions about what is going to happen at that time. Some people see the end of the cycle as an occasion where there'll be some kind of catastrophe. Others see it as, well, maybe there won't be a catastrophe,
right,
but there'll be a spiritual enlightening.
Yes, exactly.
And then some say both. You know, it'll be a catastrophe and a spiritual enlightening. Now, when I try to translate this into my Vedic understandings, it's the Kali Yuga, which means there could be some kind of catastrophe at any moment. It could be in 2012. It could be in 2013. Any time in the Kali Yuga, there could be some kind of social or environmental catastrophe. That is something that could happen at any time. It could happen in 2012 or 2015 or whatever. Now, also according to the Vedic cosmological calendar, we are now in a what we could call a mini golden age within a dark age. And this age is calculated to go on for about 9 or 10,000 years. It's like, as I said, an Indian summer with the approach of winter. Mm-hmm. So that means there could also be some kind of enlightenment occurring within this time. So those are the kinds of parallels I see between the Vedic calendar and the Mayan calendar. Those who are looking at the Mayan calendar, looking at the year 2012, say either there could be a catastrophe or an enlightenment or both. And I think, according to the Vedic calendar, I would expect the same things. There could be a catastrophe. There could be a big enlightenment. There could be both.
There could be both. Now, when you're treated by the press here and, let's say, like Russia, two different types or what?
Actually, the reactions tend to be about the same. There are some within the media or within the scientific establishment who really hate what I'm doing. They don't want to hear about it. They don't want anybody else to hear about it. There's some more open-minded people who are willing to listen, consider my ideas, and there are some who actually agree with me. And within the mainstream media and the mainstream academic and scientific and educational communities, those people are very few at the present moment. I would say that in Russia, for example, my books are published in about 20 different languages. I get invitations to go all over the world to either speak to the media or to universities or scientific institutions. And I could say that in Russia, I've been able to reach higher into the mainstream media than I have in the United States. You know, for example, you know, I've appeared on Russian national television several times, Russian national radio several times, the biggest newspapers like Pravda, Izvestia, all the big newspapers have at one time or another run major articles about me and my work. Now, I can't say that in the United States I've gotten big headlines in the New York Times and Washington Post. So I think in some countries I've been able to reach higher into the levels of the mainstream media and academic world than I have in the United States.
Michael, when we come back, let's take phone calls with you. Michael Cremo, our special guest on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast with you and Michael Cremo as well. Michael, what are the new things you're working on these days?
Well, I'm working on a new book called Forbidden Archaeology 2, which will include cases of archaeological evidence for extreme human antiquity that have come to my attention since my first book, Forbidden Archaeology, was published in 1993. And I'm also getting into an interesting topic that a friend of mine in Hungary has started researching. This man's name is István Tasi, and he's come out with a new book called Nature's IQ, which has really gotten my attention, because I've been dealing with archaeological evidence that contradicts the theory of evolution, and he's dealing with animal behaviors, strange animal behaviors that contradict the theory of evolution that can't be explained by evolution, by natural selection. One amazing case that I read about was a bird in Australia called the mallee fowl. And these birds, they lay their eggs in big nests that they scrape out of the ground. And then the amazing thing is that the egg has to be kept at a constant temperature for many, many months until it hatches. And the male bird does this. He's constantly checking the temperature of the egg. And for example, if it's getting too warm, he scrapes off some of the material, the twigs and the bushes and the dirt that's been used to cover the egg. And, you know, if it gets too cold, then he covers it up again. And it's really amazing that this bird keeps this egg at a constant temperature by exposing it to the sun or, you know, covering it up for a whole, about a year. And it's just, there are just hundreds of these cases of strange animal behaviors that really can't be explained by the theory of evolution, by natural selection. So that's something I've been looking into, and probably I'm going to include information of that kind in some other books that I'm thinking about writing. I'm also thinking, I've been getting lots of invitations to speak. One of the more interesting ones is a conference that's being held near Mount Shasta in California, June 12th to the 14th. It's called UFOs, Ancient Mysteries, and Beyond. It's going to be held at College of the Siskiyous Performing Arts Center in Weed, California, W-E-D-D, Weed, California. So a lot of that stuff's on my website, what I'm up to, what I'll be doing in the next year.
Okay, let's go to some of the calls for you. We'll go to Hollywood, Florida, east of the Rockies. Richard, you're up with us. Hey, Richard.
Hey, I wanted to ask if there was a possibility that the ancient civilizations traded resources with extraterrestrials to gain technology, and humans were pretty smart back then. They probably were given instructions or they were taught to use it, and that's how they made, like, pyramids and stuff like that. You know, do you think that's a possibility?
Yes, I do think that is a definite possibility. Of course, there are even suggestions of, for example, Colonel Carso wrote an interesting book saying that a lot of our technology today has been back-engineered from crashed UFO technology.
The Roswell crash.
Yes. And he was a pretty highly placed government official in the military who was actually involved in technological matters that had to do with the military and the government. But I would say in ancient times, the same sort of thing was going on. When we look at, say, the descriptions of how people acquired, you know, these technologies like Vimanas or spacecraft, it wasn't done in the way that we normally develop these things today. For example, we want to build an airplane. We dig into the ground. We mine ores. We refine them into metals. We get a bunch of engineers together to design an aircraft. Then we build a factory where you've got thousands of people working to put the aircraft together. In ancient times, it didn't really go like that. It seemed like these people were in contact with higher intelligences elsewhere in the cosmos, so that if they wanted some technology, what they did is they established contact with these higher beings, and they were gifted with the technologies and instructed how to use them. So that is quite different than our approach today. Today we want to do everything ourselves. So
let's go to Francis in Los Angeles, California, on the wildcard line. Francis, hi.
Yes, Mr. Cremo. I'm from Florida also. I wanted to know, do you know anything about the artifacts that's been found down in Acambaro, Mexico?
At Acambaro, Mexico, I think what we've got there was in the 1950s and earlier, there were reports that they had found down there sculptures of dinosaurs and other extinct animals. And I thought that was very interesting. They're not claimed to be very, very old from what I understand, but so they weren't exactly in my field of evidence for extreme human antiquity, but was an interesting case.
Okay, next up. Thanks for your call, Francis. Let's go to Robbie driving around in North Carolina. Truckee, actually. Hey, Rob, go ahead.
Hey, George. How you doing? Great show.
Good.
Tonight. Great show.
He's good.
You know, I'm your optimistic skeptic, and I just love this topic. Ever since I was 10 with Van Doneken, you know, and the only this physical evidence with the bare feet in the million and a half year old rock and the one next to dinosaurs, great. But in terms of technological advancement of past civilizations, I would feel a lot better if that foot had an Adidas shoe on it. You know, we had like an Adidas tennis shoe print instead of just a bare footprint. That would show some technology.
Robert, there are things like that. There was a case in Nevada where a researcher discovered a shoe print in Triassic formations, which means they'd be over, 150 million years old. And the shoe, he took the specimen to New York City, and he had microphotographs made of it. And in the shoe print, he could actually see the threads. You know, like if you look at the bottom of a well-made shoe, you'll see that the sole is sewn on to the main body of the shoe with threads. And these microphotographs showed in this fossil specimen of a shoe print the threads. You could see them in the bottom of the print. There's also a case that I report in Forbidden Archaeology from Antelope Springs in Utah, where a researcher named William Meister found a shoe print in Cambrian formations. And my co-author, Richard Thompson, went to visit Mr. Meister when he was still alive, and he personally showed him the specimen of this shoe print and a piece of rock, shale rock, and the shoe had crushed a trilobite fossil, and a trilobite is an animal, shellfish, that lived during the Cambrian period, which goes back, you know, about 600 million years. So there are reports of shoe prints, not just bare footprints, from many, many millions of years ago. So thanks for that question.
Okay, great. Let's go to Mike in Wisconsin, first-time caller. Thanks for calling, Mike. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm going to have to ask you guys to give me a course in Archaeology 101. I have not heard the term intelligent design used, although I do not have a particular agenda. It's just that I have an awfully tough time believing that I'm related somehow to my dog.
Well,
so many others are too. Go ahead.
Well, Mike, I think the term intelligent design is perfectly appropriate. You know, when we look at living things, at the forms of living things on the biomolecular level, we see there's extremely complex machinery there. There's more complex machinery than what we use today within our bodies. And normally when we see a bit of complex machinery, we think, well, someone must have designed it. And this is especially true if no one has yet been able to show exactly how these very complex forms of biomolecular machinery arose in detail by evolution by natural selection. Then I think intelligent design does become a possibility, and I do believe there are higher intelligences in the universe who did have something to do with the origin of the life forms that we observe on Earth today. So, yes, I think that's it's perfectly appropriate to use the term intelligent design in discussions of these things. So thanks for bringing that up.
All right, there you go, Mike. Appreciate you being on the program. Next up, let's go to David in New York on the wild card line. David, you're on with Michael Cremo.
Hello, yes. Hi, George.
Hi.
I'm very happy to be calling. I'm a first-time caller. I've been listening to your show for a while, especially like late nights. All right, let me get to my question for your guest. Sir, I want to know, like, seriously, if you truly believe that, like, you know, coming 2012, if it's more going to be nothing but, like, catastrophic and, like, disaster, or do you think there's, like, any sort of, like, promise of something, like, good to happen, or if nothing's going to happen at all, perhaps maybe we'll just, like, go on as if, like, just, like, normal days, I mean.
Or as he thinks. They might both happen. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, they might both happen. I think it's just something we're just going to have to wait and see what actually happens in 2012. It could be a catastrophe because according to the way that I'm looking at things from my Vedic perspective, it's the Kali Yuga. It's an age of catastrophes, so something could happen in that. It's not guaranteed as far as I'm concerned, but it may happen. I do think We are also, as I said, according to the Vedic cosmological calendar, in a bit of an upturn, just like when winter's coming, you may get a few warm days. So I think we're at a time when spiritual enlightenment is always possible, when there can be some very positive developments. And I think that depends more on us than anything else, whether that's going to happen. I think we need to keep a positive outlook. We need to, it's just like I said, just because it rains, it doesn't mean you have to get wet. You can put up an umbrella. You can shelter yourself. You can shelter your friends. But that depends on us preparing to do that and being willing to do that. So I think, yes, if enough people prepare themselves in the right way, it could be a time of spiritual advancement, spiritual enlightenment, things getting better. Or sometimes both of these things could happen at the same time. I think we're just going to have to wait and see what really happens in 2012.
Okay, very good. Thanks, Michael. Quincy, Illinois caller Jeff, east of the Rockies. Hi, Jeff.
Hello, George, and thank you for taking my call.
Of course.
I have a question for you, Dr. Cremo. First of all, I want to thank both of you for doing what you do, and please don't ever stop. I have a question about tunnels that have found that supposedly have been found deep in the earth, and these tunnels supposedly predate the so-called caveman, and I wondered if you had come across anything like this. The tunnels look like they were intelligently constructed. I don't know if they really exist. I've just heard about this, and I'll take my answer on the radio. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Okay. Jeff, there are accounts of such things in the ancient Sanskrit writings, and different teachers from India, including my own guru, have said that there were tunnels going from South America to a place called Lanka in India, and these tunnels were being used to transport gold from Brazil, from the Brazilian area, where there is a lot of gold, to a place called Lanka, which is now the island nation of Sri Lanka off the coast of India, or at least that's what some people think. So there are accounts of these things. I have personally heard people that I know who have gone to South America, to the Andes Mountains, and they say that in Peru there are tunnels that appear to go vast distances under the earth. So I've heard about such things. I think it'd be a great topic for further research and confirmation of these things. But I have heard these reports. There are things in the ancient literatures about these things. So what you're saying is sort of consistent with that, but I think we need some bold researchers to actually go into these things. Now, I lived in Hawaii for a long time, and they have lava tunnels there, which aren't man-made. They're the result of lava flows, and when the lava flows out of these tubes, just the tubes remain. So some of these tunnels could be something like that, but others could in fact be man-made, but I think that's a topic for further research and investigation. Thanks for bringing up that interesting topic.
Let's go to Battleground Washington. Dean, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi, Dean.
Hi, thanks.
Sure.
Michael, I love everything I've read that you've done, and agree with most of it. And I just I'm just more likely to think that the humans have not been around as long as you say they have, and that the fossil record and the geological record is basically the young Earth. The Earth is a lot younger than most geological records would, you know, whatever the estimate would be.
Well,
what do you think about the Neil Gaiman's the growing Earth theory?
Well, first of all, back to your point about the ages. I realize there are many people who accept a young Earth concept, and although I personally don't accept that myself, I respect it as a viewpoint. And the basic point I try to make to such people is whether we believe the Earth is a few thousand or a few billion years old, humans have been around from the beginning, and they didn't come from apes. And usually we're able to agree on that much, at least. And then as far as the age of the Earth, well, we're just going to have to differ about that. But it appears to be, in terms of the larger issue, a relatively minor one. As far as the expanding Earth theories go, it's something I'm prepared to consider, you know, in terms of the reality of such a thing. The ancient Sanskrit writings speak of things getting bigger and smaller over vast courses of time, and that may include, you know, the size of the planet as well. So it's something I'm prepared to consider. I can't say that I've looked very, very deeply into that expanding Earth theory at the present time, but it's something I'm willing to consider.
Michael, we'll be back with you in a moment. We'll take final phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, we're with Michael Cremo. We'll take your calls. Michael, the conference that you came back from in India, how do they treat Americans? What do you think?
I got treated very, very well there. I spoke at about 50 different universities and scientific institutions. Of course, what I was talking about was my book, Human Devolution, A Vedic Alternative to Darwin's Theory. So India, of course, is the homeland of the Vedic culture and the ideas that inspire me in my work. So there are many people there, including those in the scientific and academic establishments, who are a bit sympathetic to what I'm trying to do. So I was received very well there. You know, I was kept nicely in the university guest houses. I met the directors and the presidents of the universities and the scientific institutions I was visiting. There was a nice response from the students and the faculty members who came to the talks. So it was pretty good. And now in other countries, it's a little bit different. There's also interest, but there's a little bit more opposition. For example, last fall I went to Russia and I spoke at a lot of scientific institutions and universities there. In one city in Siberia, in Tumen, it's kind of interesting that there are big modern cities in Siberia. I didn't know that. It's like the gas and oil part of the country, so it's like Texas with cities like Dallas, Fort Worth, and all that there. I thought it was a pretty desolate place, but there's some big modern cities in Siberia, and I was at one of them in Tumen, and some professors had invited me to speak at a university there, but at the last moment, the president of the university canceled the lecture because he'd been pressured by outside groups of scientists and others who really objected to the fact that I'd be speaking against the theory of evolution at these schools. So the professors, they went to the president of the university. They tried to convince him to change his mind. He said, no, I'm not going to change my mind. So then these professors went to the local branch of the Russian Academy of Sciences, which is really higher in the academic hierarchy than the university. They explained the situation to the director, and he said, Michael Cremo will speak here, and nobody will put any pressure on me. So the lecture was transferred from the university to the Russian Academy of Sciences branch, and they had buses bring students and professors from the university, and the lecture was just packed. And the professors told me more people came than would have come if the lecture had been held as scheduled at the university itself, because the whole school was talking about why the president cancel this guy's lecture. What has he got to say that's so dangerous? You know?
That's what does it all the time.
Right. And actually, in February, I was speaking at a university in Denmark, and Aarhus is the second biggest city in Denmark. And many archaeology professors and other science professors at the university protested. They weren't able to cancel the lecture, but they protested. And there were big headlines in the newspaper there. It said, is this man dangerous? You know, why are the professors so angry that he's speaking at the university? So, Yeah, you do get different reactions. But in India, it was really positive because that is the homeland of the ideas that inspire me in my work. And in addition to speaking at a lot of universities and scientific institutions there, I also got a chance to visit some sacred places like Rishikesh and the Himalayan mountains. I got to take a bath in the Ganges River there, which I'd always wanted to do up in the Himalayas. And so it was altogether, it was a very positive experience for me.
Great. Okay, back to the phones we go. Let's go to Boston, Mass. JC, I wonder if it is. Well, go ahead, JC.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
Good.
Like you, I read up a lot of the Vedas and all that. I was into that a lot. And, but, you know, reading all different things, and I've also read the Urantia book, the whole thing.
Cover.
And just reading all different schools of thought and traditions and religions and spiritual traditions, I don't know, I come to the conclusion that, you know, looking at the exasperating endless cycle and pendulum of, like, you know, all this reincarnation and everything, it's probably real if you believe in it, but I also think that, you know, it's all illusion that, I guess in the sense that it's all like a counterfeit creation and designed to siphon everything from God, you know. The Urantia book talks about the supreme being is going to be this being that evolves by the actual being of the super creations, the super universes, all this, you know. God's the supreme being. And I think Jesus' picture of the ultimate God is more perfect than anything else. I mean, Krishna even tells Arjuna it's all right to kill. It's all right to line up against his own brethren and in this war to kill, as long as, you know, he's fulfilling his thing. But he's given him license. You know, that falls short of a perfect God. And all this creation always ending up in all this decay and, you know, all this chaos falls short of a divine creation. I think the whole thing is counterfeit. It's a stamp. It's against God. It's like what David Quayle said about how it's like stealing the design. I mean, even when it says God, you know, when he says, let's, all of a sudden he's with others, he goes, let us create man in our image. You know, it's all these false gods parading around, you know, telling man the wrong thing. I think Jesus is the only way. So I just wanted to offer that up. And all right, God bless. Good night to you, gentlemen.
All right. Your reaction to some of this, Michael?
Well, first of all, I don't claim to have a monopoly on truth. I believe truth can be found in many different places. It can be found in Christianity. It can be found in Islam. It can be found in Hinduism. So I'm prepared to recognize truth wherever I find it. And in JC's statements, I find a little bit of truth. Well, of course, yeah, he objected to the idea that there might be some legitimate circumstances in which violence is actually allowed. I believe there are circumstances in which violence can be legitimately employed. You know, for example, if I'm, you know, sitting somewhere and you know, somebody comes to kill some innocent person who's sitting next to me, I would feel obligated to try to defend that person against a violent attack. So I don't believe that, I'm not a supporter of complete nonviolence. I believe that violence employed for the wrong purposes is wrong, but I believe there are circumstances in which violence is justified in order to respond to certain injustices and improper use of violence. On the larger point of this being a counterfeit reality, in a sense, I agree with that. This is an artificial reality. I believe that as beings of pure consciousness, we belong on the level of pure consciousness where we should be existing in loving harmony with the source of all conscious beings, which you can call God if you like, and with all other conscious beings. And I believe the only reason this material universe exists is that because a certain percentage of those conscious cells existing on that level become selfish or egotistical, and they need a place to act out their selfish desires, and that's this level of reality. But we can also graduate from this level of reality and go back to our original position. So, I would say that, yes, people are parading around pretending to being egotistical means thinking you're God yourself, really.
Okay, next up, Kansas City, Missouri. Hello, Margaret. Go ahead. Margaret?
Oh, yes, Margaret. Thank you for taking my call. I have actually two questions.
Sure.
One of them is, has he considered the concept of Pangaea, where the continent was really small, and that would explain maybe why all these things are so far under the earth and that they existed? And the other question I have is, if he doesn't believe in the Darwin theory of evolution, the Bible starts at a certain time, and so if his theory is what it is, why isn't the Bible say anything about human beings existing before that? And I am one of those 5% scientists who believe in a supreme being, and I just came back from the Eureka Springs, Arkansas MUFON conference. So I am totally energized in... This is the first exposure I have to this man, and those are my two questions. Thank you
for taking my call.
Okay,
sure,
okay,
thing.
Margaret, thanks for the questions. Yeah, as far as Pangaea is concerned, the idea that all the continents were once united, I'm not opposed to that idea. So that's something I'm not opposed to. And about what the Bible mentions, basically I see... You know, if we look cross-culturally at all the great spiritual traditions of the world, pretty much all of them say that God created human beings as they are now in the beginning. And that is there in the Bible. You know, in the beginning, said God created man in his image or something like that. The Bible doesn't say God said, let me create a monkey and let him evolve into a man. So I think the basic position I'm outlining is consistent with what, you know, we find in the Bible, namely that humans and other life forms were manifested at the beginning of life on Earth, and that's something we see reflected in practically all of the great wisdom traditions of the world, whether it's Christianity or Hinduism or Islam or Judaism. They all pretty much say the same thing. None of them say, first God made a monkey, and then he turned him into a human being.
Okay, let's go to Leota, west of the Rockies. Hi, Leota.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. Beautiful, beautiful, wonderful topic. The Father Creator says there's nothing new under the sun. And actually, Scripture does say that there was a world that was. So that's, you know, the Father says that. This is only 6 days in his creation. Because it's 1,000 years of his years, of our years, excuse me, is one of his days. So this earth age is only almost the end of 6,000. But what I wanted to ask you, I think this is incredibly amazing. And I don't know if you know of this or not, but it's scientifically proven. And how it came to be was doctors in emergency rooms started to discover that people's heartbeats were less on the seventh day, from Friday to Saturday, sundown to sundown, which he calls the Sabbath day, what the Father calls the Sabbath day. So he began to research, and then they discovered through even veterinarians the same thing with animals. And that's a beautiful thing. So we are caused to be rest. The Father kept his part of the covenant for us to come unto rest, even though we don't keep, you know, not everyone remembers the Sabbath. But that's scientifically proven. And I'm sorry I don't have the link, but I can send it to you.
Well, that's very nice. That's a very interesting observation. My work is basically inspired by the same kinds of considerations. For example, you're pointing out that in a sacred scripture, there's a day of rest. And you've looked at some scientific evidence that appears to confirm that. So my inspiration was the same. I read in the ancient Sanskrit writings that human civilizations existed in the distant past. So I thought, well, if that's true, there should be some physical evidence to support it. And in fact, there is. There's enough to fill up a 900-page book, Forbidden Archaeology. So I think your methodology is very interesting. You're trying to get insights from a spiritual tradition, and you're not being dogmatic about it. You're just saying, well, there appears to be medical evidence that supports that idea, and I think that's a very good procedure. So thank you, Leota.
We're going to Hell right now, Hell, Michigan. Dave, east of the Rockies. Hey, Dave, go ahead.
Hi, George.
Hi.
Hey, hi, Mike.
Hi.
My question was kind of similar to another caller's earlier, except that it's a little phrased a little differently, is you've been talking about, like, the sciences of Darwin theory being disproven, but I was wondering what your thoughts are on, like, the science of geochronology, which is, you know, it's the science of geological time.
Right.
And how that there's, you know, quite a few problems even with trying to find a standard for, you know, like, the age of the Earth.
Right. I agree with you there. There are problems with geochronology. But here's what my methodology was. I was trying to engage in a discussion with the mainstream scientists who support the theory of evolution and who base their claims not just on fossil evidence and things like that, but also on geochronology. So what I say to them, now I'm prepared to find out, you know, that the whole system of geochronology is wrong, the dating methods are wrong, the ages are wrong, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. However, if I'm going to engage in a discussion with these mainstream scientists, you have to have some framework for discussion. So my method has been this. According to your understandings of geochronology, the age of this or that formation is so-and-so many millions of years old. So how do you explain the presence of this human bone, this human footprint, or this human artifact in this very ancient layer of rock, which according to your understanding of geochronology is maybe, let's say, 50 million years old. So either they have to admit that, well, there's evidence that contradicts their theory of evolution, or they have to admit all their dating methods, all their understanding about the age of the Earth, the geochronology, is wrong. Either way, I win. If you see what I mean.
Absolutely. Michael, we're almost out of time. I want to thank you so much. Websites, all three of them are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Human Devolution, there's an order number, 1-800-443-3361. Can they order off your websites and Amazon, Michael?
They can order off my websites or on the other internet book-selling sites. Books are pretty widely available.
Michael Cremo, for Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasur, Tim Banal, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.